Greetings and salutations, and welcome to another episode of Linux Lads. As you can tell, I am not Shane. I am Connor. Shane is off gallivanting somewhere on his holidays. So one time we had Mike off in Spain or somewhere in Eastern Europe or something. Now Shane is off gallivanting off somewhere. We don't even know where he is. He's probably sipping a margarita on a Jamaican beach or something. And of course, we're also joined by Mike. Say hello, Mike.
Hi, people. I'm also not Shane.
Okay, so I suppose we'll get into this. So as we kind of mentioned on our socials and everything, this one is a bit delayed, so sorry about that. We had kind of a few things going on last weekend, so we couldn't record last weekend. And also, this is our last episode before we take our bit of our summer break. So we will be taking a break of roughly about a month, so two episodes, and we'll be back in sometime in September, which is about as specific as we're going to be for the moment. And this one is just going to be loosey-goosey, no real structure to it. We'll get through a bit of news, we'll get do a bit of discussions, some feedback that people have provided on Twitter and so on. We have a coupon code for 30% off when you pay for 3 months of Azure VPN. They are a security-focused VPN provider based in Sweden, where the law does not require them to log traffic. They operate servers in Europe and North America. Their servers are owned, not rented, and installed on location by their engineers and are running Debian Linux. They provide WireGuard and OpenVPN options. Their client is GPL v2 licensed and is available on Linux. They take all major payments, including cryptocurrencies, and they don't even require you to give them an email address. So if you use the code LinuxLads when you're ordering, make sure you click the green add code button to get the discount, and the discount is valid until the 1st of January 2020. So now we have a bit of news that we'll be getting through. Mike, you added this one in. Is Facebook got slapped with a $5 billion fine?
Yeah, so Facebook is being fined by the American Federal Trade Commission, if I'm reading the abbreviation properly. It's for their everlasting efforts to get our data to the farthest corners of the universe with everybody and their dog have access to them. So, you know, everybody remembers the Cambridge Analytica case, and there's been others where Facebook just sold people's data like it's going out of style. And they kind of agreed on settlement, which is $5 billion. It's a lot of money from almost everyone's perspective, but only just about a month's worth of revenue for Facebook. And it's the biggest fine FTC has ever dealt to anybody. I don't know what to say, just meh. I mean, I don't know what you would have to do at this point to actually make them feel it, because $5 billion, I don't know if it even means anything to them. If they just look behind the sofa, find a change and give it to the FCC or something.
It's just the whole thing of it just boggles the mind that there's a company that it's $5 billion is a month's worth of revenue for them. And that is effectively, it's a slight great step up from a slap on the wrist for them. I mean, if it was like 600 million or something like that, Facebook would be like, oh, whatever. So it's a slight step up above that, but they're not exactly really kind of feeling it. If it's a lyric, they'll just write it off and going, okay, that was a bad month revenue wise, next month will probably be better. It's literally all it's going to be is just going to be a note at the end of it. It's just boggles the mind that a company could be that large where $5 billion just means nothing to them.
Also, it's an amazing statement on how much our data is actually worth, because they make $5 billion in a month, and they don't create anything. It's all just people's data and advertising. Like, how that's a massive amount of money that they make. And on the other hand, it's nothing to them. I don't know. It's just my mind is boggled officially. I just can't even comprehend this. I think, yeah, I often talk here about how these companies need to be broken down and how the concerns need to be separated between people who between platforms and content creation and advertising. This is just, for me, this is just an example, and I don't know what else to say. It's like bordering on the ridiculous.
I will attempt to make a bit of a positive spin on not necessarily this specific article, but just Facebook being the behemoth that it is there's a Facebook open source team inside Facebook, and they have a Twitter account, and they have their own website, and apparently that team do actually write some quite compelling projects and everything like that. So there's apparently it's actually, so it's, I'm not, yeah, I Mike is shaking his head there in the background, but yeah, but it is a kind of a positive spin. Like, there is a massive behemoth, but at least there's some kind of agile little team inside it that is actually doing some good. That's what I'm saying.
I'm not saying, look, as Jono Bacon keeps saying on Bad Voltage, there are many very good and nice people working for Facebook, and I don't disagree. Like, it's such a big company that I don't for a second believe that it's just like the... I don't know, that is the consulate of hell on the air for
devil incarnate.
Yeah, I don't know, you know, I don't know anybody personally who works there, but I'm sure it's nice people, and they do produce some really neat stuff, like React, that is the probably the most popular JavaScript framework for making interfaces and stuff. That's made by them and made freely available for everybody, and I think there's been some controversy about it about a year ago, but they released it under open source license, and it's there for everyone to use, and everybody uses it, and it's great. You know, the same with Google. They do ton of great stuff. Microsoft, the same thing. You know, everybody does a lot of good stuff, but unfortunately, the bulk of their business is taking your data and selling it and making it, like, piles upon piles in the process. So, yeah, that's all I can say about it. It's mind-boggling.
Anyone is free feel to correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I thought they're one of the larger organizations running ButterFS as on their servers or something like that. That might be old news, and they may have switched away from that, but I thought that they were one of the larger people using rolling out or deploying ButterFS.
Yeah, I think that was, if I remember correctly, there was a bit of a bad spin on ButterFS on that one as well, because ButterFS has got, as file systems go, it has got a reputation for being unstable, some would say even unfinished. And when people started pointing out, like, it's production ready, look, Facebook are using it, but, and some other people say, yeah, the way they use it, they are using it all in RAM, in memory. So there is no persistence needed for it. So if it crashes, well, it crashes, they reboot it. So I don't exactly, obviously, I don't know how they use it. But yeah, they built upon open source infrastructure. They enrich the ecosystem. They help out a lot of people with new technology, even the proprietary stuff that they keep inventing, like you know, WhatsApp is terrible and everything, but it does, even Facebook, you know, it's horrible and everything, but it does connect communities. You know, it does give connection to people who wouldn't otherwise be able to talk to each other. It's just, it has a dark side, and the dark side has to be, you know, the dark side has to be investigated and regulate it. And if there is something really bad going on, that has to be stopped. That's it, really.
I was just smirking while because it popped into my head while you're making that discussion was just, I don't know, maybe it's just the wording that you're using, but I was like, are Facebook the new people who are doing the triple E? I doubt that that's true, but it's just that's the reason why I was kind of. Obviously, the audio listeners would not be privy to it, but I was kind of smirking in the background while Mike was talking there.
Just that people who don't know what do you mean by triple E, it's not like three pills of ecstasy. It's more like what Microsoft
expand, embrace, extinguish.
Exactly. So it's a business strategy where you take in what your competitor does and expand upon it with proprietary measures and then throw it away. I don't know if Facebook are exactly doing that. They don't seem to be monetizing software. Like they are monetizing your data. So it's a kind of a different business. But and they do other nefarious stuff as proven by the FTC ruling or settlement or whatever it is. But it's Facebook, eh?
My take on triple E or expand, embrace, extinguish, I think was the whole idea was like Microsoft in the 90s were doing it, was that there'll be a pre-existing product and then Microsoft would expand upon that product, saying, oh, so you're already running this, but what we're doing is we add a couple of extra features. And then Microsoft, because they're such a big developer powerhouse, their added on features would be quite well made. And then they just kept iterating on their thing. And then the whole thing is they're saying, well, our add-ons have become so essential that the industry effectively moves to have the core product plus their expanded on add-ons as the standard. And then Microsoft, effectively, then the industry just shifts towards just using the Microsoft add-ons exclusively, and then the original product just whittles and dies away, is essentially what the whole triple E strategy was.
Yeah, it comes from the Gates Ballmer era of Microsoft and they did it to Novell famously, I think, or something, but that's ancient history. I was very little when that happened, and people won't let them forget it, especially on places like Reddit,
and thankfully with GPL code, it's impossible for them to do that. I'm not saying that is their strategy currently. They're very much saying that Microsoft are a changed company. I'm not saying that is anyway their current policy, but even if it was their current policy, it would be effectively impossible for them to do that, because it's like GPL code, we can just fork it.
Are you talking about the way they've been included on some on the distro's mailing list recently, and the way they are now using basically the Linux kernel and the Windows subsystem for Linux too, or something?
No, just in general. I wasn't talking about anything in specifically. I think it's a specific team within Microsoft has been added onto that, and there has been debates about whether the addition onto that Security Council or whatever should just be called Microsoft, or should be called whatever's internal team within Microsoft is the people responsible. And it's not the case of Microsoft are just suddenly saying we demand to be on this, as in it's one or two guys who have shown that they're legit part of the community, and they've been contributing a shit ton of code and everything, so that people are the security team were like, okay, yeah, that's fair enough, like they if they apply to be on the council, then they have a track record of being very good, and those couple of guys, they deserve to be on the council. It's not Microsoft themselves. It's not like it's going to be some senior exec from Microsoft who's going to be sitting on that security council. It's a couple of Microsoft employees who've shown their track record of being very good. So the debate was whether it should just be called these one or two guys from Microsoft or with these couple of guys from whatever security team within Microsoft. There is a whole lot of hyperbole with news headlines around that of Microsoft is joining the security team. No, it's a couple of guys who happen to be Microsoft employees who have shown the track record of being very good within the Linux security community and because they've applied to it, and then the guys are like, okay, yeah, you legit deserve to be on that because you've contributed the vast amount of code or whatever, or have you been an active member of on the in the security ecosystem. Anyway, moving on. The next headline, it was another one added by Mike. And this is actually very good news, and I kind of wish that Shane was here to discuss this as well, because he's a big advocate of this piece of software. So Ubisoft and Epic have thrown their financial support towards Blender. So they're...
Yeah, it's two pieces of good news for Blender in, was it 1 week or 10 days? So Epic Games, the creators of Unreal Tournament and Fortnite, and PUBG, if I'm not mistaken, right?
I don't use those, or I haven't played those games. So,
you know, you wouldn't, none of their stuff, as far as I know, is available for Linux. So they basically awarded Blender $1.2 million from their Mega Grants program. I think they are going to give it to them over a course of some years, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's a trickle. It's not the case of here's a check for $1.2 million and then... Like, have at it. You could spend it all at once if you want. But it's the kind of thing, it's going to be going through in bits and pieces over a certain set period of time.
And that's one thing. And then Ubisoft, another game and animation studio, they became a corporate gold member, which I think is to the tune of $30,000 a year of the Blender Foundation's development fund. So... they will start using Blender as their main digital content creation tool, which is basically, so it's a lot of money, and it's also acknowledgement of how just how bloody good and professional grade Blender is. I mean, for me, I open it, I panic, and once I overcome the heart attack, I close it and start using something else. But this is obviously an endorsement on the highest level. These companies see how great Blender is, and also how helpful it is to have open source project that's available for everybody. I'm pretty sure that this is, they must have done some evaluations and they must have done some cost analysis. And if they are throwing this money at it, that means that they reckon it's cheaper for them and more valuable to support an open source project than having something like this developed in-house or buy it from a third party. So this is just not only endorsement of Blender, but this is endorsement of open source. And absolutely positive news.
Without a doubt. And it's showing serious... as you were saying, it's showing serious credence towards Blender as a tool. If the very fact that they're saying, yep, this is professional grade. In other words, this is up with, I do not know the 3D, the rival 3D modeling software. So this is up with your proprietary 3D modeling software of a nameless one that I would not be able to name because I'm not familiar with it.
Maya, for example.
It's a recognition that Blender is up to that quality and at least matching that quality. And they probably noticed that a lot of their artists are probably using Blender anyway. And they're just thinking, okay, well, if our staff are using it, there's no better acknowledgement of its quality than our staff are using it in their day-to-day job. So then it was probably... They could have been doing this for years and using it for free. No doubt that they probably have been using this for years free within the organization. And then the cost analysis just came up and said, listen, guys, there's this tool that our organization is relying upon. And they might even have internal constraints or internal things of saying, okay, Blender is a really good tool, but we kind of wish that it did X. Well, if you want to provide that feedback to the developers who make Blender, then pony up for it. In other words, if you want the development hours to implement X, which is the feature that you want to add in to Blender, then throw money or for development time in order to implement X. So if they're doing this on an annual basis, that means that they effectively have their influence on the development of Blender. So for example, Ubisoft with their 30 grand a year, they're saying, okay, we're contributing 30 grand a year and we're using this tool. But if anything comes up within our organization of Blender is a really good tool, but we wish that it did something, then they essentially have a hotline to say, hey, we've paid for a developer their 30 grand a year. We've paid for a developer or the vast majority of his salary or whatever like that. It's like, it's fine that during his day-to-day job, he's just working on Blender in general, but could we get him to implement X for our organization since we're effectively paying his salary? So that kind of influence is where I can see it.
Yeah, I agree. And it's good that it's not just one organization, so no one organization will have complete control. And because it's still a community project, it still is protected from that way as well. So yeah, I can't see anything negative about this.
Oh no, certainly is. This is all positive. Ultimately, it's the Blender Foundation's decision what direction Blender goes in. But though is those peripheral cases where we're talking about where Ubisoft is saying, okay, we're employing, I don't know, globally 1,000 3D artists. I'm just making up a figure. And so we're a very heavy user of Blender, and also it's a benefit of Blender as well, because then that the code effectively gets battle hardened, because if there's 1,000 or 5,000 developers globally who are relying upon it, then all the little stability bugs and all that all will get reported up, and they will all get get ironed out a lot quicker than if it was just if they didn't have that amount of information to tap, essentially. If they're just saying, okay, we are vaguely aware that organizations around the world are using our product, but if they say, okay, we know that Ubisoft have 5,000, again, I'm just making up a figure, 5,000 employees or 5,000 developers across the world who are using our tool day in, day out. And that means that if Ubisoft have raised something saying, yeah, when you click on this, we're expecting this to happen and it doesn't happen, and or something along those lines, then that gets solved pretty quickly, because Ubisoft are providing financial support for that as well. And the same thing will go with from Epic Games. You can exact same scenario, but copy and paste it over to Epic Games, where Epic Games is saying, okay, we're using this tool, and they might be using it in an entirely different way, but and that is even better if they're using the tool in an entirely different way than Ubisoft or any other development house are using the tool, because that means the Blender gets stressed in another direction. And this can only be good for the development of free and open source software.
Yep, absolutely, I agree.
Okay, moving on. This one I'll mention very briefly, but KDE Connect is now been ported over to Windows 10. So all you people over in Windows 10, it's like giving people a glass of water when they're in the desert. thoughts, Mike, very briefly?
No. I mean, yeah, it's good. It's good that we can spread Linux goodness to other operating systems and tell other people what they are missing. I know. I think it's already been ported to the Mac platform. I don't think Mac has had anything like this. Maybe for the iPhone, but not for Android. So now you can connect your Android device to your Windows, or maybe it's being ported, so maybe in the future soon you should be able to use KDE Connect with your Windows computer. I don't know if they are adding this feature, but maybe if they add in something that would uninstall Candy Crush once on new Windows 10 installs, that might be helpful as well. And other ways of getting rid of making Windows a bit more useful. But I don't know if they are built in that kind of a feature.
And it seems to be that it was a result of Google Summer of Code. So that is a way that Google is positively contributing to the open source movement. The next one is how to mirror and control your Android phone from your Ubuntu desktop. Tangentially related, because I think with KDE Connect you can do sort of-ish the same things, but this would actually show the preview of your screen up on your Ubuntu desktop. So you'll actually see what your phone is actually doing. It's SCORCPY. Which I guess is a truncated form of screen copy. I'm just going to call it Scrippy because it's easier to pronounce. It's coming from OMG Ubuntu. And so if you want to see the visual representation of somebody's Android phone appearing on their Ubuntu desktop, then click on the link in the show notes. Mike, any thoughts on this?
Not really. I mean, I think the SCRCPY thing was done by somebody who knows the STRCPY or string copy. Is it built in from the C language? It's a kind of a very nerdy joke. Other than that, I can see how it can be useful for people. Probably not for me, but yeah, more functionality and more choice is always good.
Alrighty. Very good news. A new Pinebrook Pro video demos 4K video, external monitor support, and WebGL. I think they're getting Quake 3 running on the Pinebrook Pro. Thanks to Lucas, and the article that we're linking is from OMG Ubuntu. And in the article, it says the orders are live as of the 25th, but as of this recording, we're past the 25th, so we'll say that the pre-orders are now live as of the 25th. So that's very good.
Yeah, so these are the pre-orders for the Pinebook Pro. I think there is the members of the forum, or people who were members of the forum, of the Fine64 forum on July the 1st, are in priority for that, and they have got some hardware upgrade for free there as well, I think, storage wise.
I think they're going from their hard drive is going from 64 to 128 or maybe 32 to 64, I'm not sure.
Yeah, something like that for the eMMC storage. So we've talked about the Pinebook Pro for a long time on this podcast, and about all the other stuff that Pine64 do. I will admit that I'm a big fan of theirs because they release Linux hardware for the hobbyists, and with the Pinebook Pro they are now reaching out to like people who just need a daily driver computer. And I like their style where they just, here are our products. This is what they are meant for. And it's basically, I like that company, and I also like their pricing. I think that the PineBook Pro is gonna be. I mean, I hope it's gonna be as good as I think it's gonna be. So,
and yeah, when you're talking about the price point, $200 full retail price for this, which is amazing, and as a click on the article to see the demonstrations, but you are seeing 4K videos, as I said, hooking up to an external monitor, so you could use this as your portable work device, and then go into your laptop and then hook it up to an external monitor. Obviously, it is running ARM, but two things that brings down the cost. The reason why they're able to target $200 for a 14-inch laptop, and also great for battery life as well. There might be an issue about not every application has been cross-compiled for the ARM architecture, but I would imagine that as more ARM devices are getting out there, that will gradually be solved. And another potential solution for that is just install Arch and then get everything from the AUR, and probably the AUR might cross-compile it, I don't know.
It's always a solution to install Arch. Although I have some experience with the AUR on the PineBook, on the original, on the 1080p yeah. PineBook, and it doesn't always work. Mostly, basically, I think it would work in many cases if you were able to mess around with it, but I'm not that technical, so I don't go inside the package scripts and I don't change the compiler flags and stuff like that, because that would be more work for me than what the software is, well, than the need for the software. But
For me, that'll be oh hell no.
Yeah, but for the desired purpose. So for what they say, this is meant to be like the competitor to the Chromebooks, which already are on the market. So Chromebooks are made for people who browse, maybe some lightish content creation, studying, lightweight computers with ton of memory life. I don't know.
Battery life,
yeah. Ton of battery life and really great price point. And I think from what we've seen, this is going to be exactly that. It's for people who like to carry their computer around, like to have it available all the time, people who want to do it on a budget, and people who want to browse the web, people who want to write, research, even coding, I can imagine it's going to be working because you can install Vim, obviously. So that's
one thing I will say is it's a similar price point to a Chromebook, and it'll be similar dimensions to a Chromebook. I mean, this is a 14-inch laptop. This is way more powerful in terms of both hardware and, well, at the price point I'm talking about. Obviously, there's really expensive Chromebooks. At the price point that we're talking about, it's way more powerful than the competing Chromebooks for the same price, and also way more powerful in terms of freedom, as in the Chromebook is severely locked down. You can't now. They've kind of retroactively said, "Oh, you can install Linux apps like GIMP and things like that, and everything." But all of that is just kind of tacked on layer afterthought. This will run everything natively. You are running Linux, and not only that, is in the traditional Linux open source sense. It will come with a distribution. You don't have to stick to that distribution if you don't want to. You can install Manjaro. You can install. There will be other images available at launch, and this has been, working in the background. And I've asked Lucas directly, and he's confirmed it that you don't have to stick to whatever the PineBook comes with. The PineBook Pro comes with, if you do not want to. What it will come with is Debian with a Mate desktop, which is will be a very good, very solid distribution of Linux, and it will be it's specific for that, so it will be optimized. But there will also be Manjaro, there will also be other Linux distributions, the names escape me at the moment, but there will be about two or three other options. I'm sure there will be Ubuntu will probably be available eventually. I did not know, but there certainly at launch, I say there will be probably be a three or four options that you can install on this if you do not wish to stick with what it comes with default. And I mean, this is really exciting for me because the build quality of the original is plastic, which is not necessarily a bad thing. It's durable. This will be all metal, which is really, really exciting. For $200, this is a metal laptop with a decent keyboard, is what I heard early reports. So obviously I'll have to wait until I get my hands on one, but decent keyboard, good solid build quality, for great battery life. I mean, at the moment I'm looking at my ThinkPad T450 and I'm thinking, am I going to be using two laptops? Because if I will be getting one of these Pinebooks without a doubt, because it's so cheap and it's such a cool device to be able to check out. I now have to have a serious debate in my head of whether I keep my T450, even though that has a Core i5 and like 8 gigs of RAM and like a very decent powerful laptop with a 500 gig SSD in it, very decent powerful laptop. But am I going to be running with two laptops? So I have to have a serious debate in my head once I get this Pinebook Pro.
Yeah, exactly. It's definitely coming.
Okay, next bit of news, very briefly. Only Office has come up with a new version. Seems to be quite a lot of new features, which is good. And also, it's an open source Office suite that's cross-platform Windows, Mac, and Linux. So it's always good to have competition. Even though we heart LibreOffice on this podcast, it's always good to have competition. So good on you, OnlyOffice, for being another open source Office suite that's cross-platform out there. More power to you.
I've tried using it before. It has got some nice points, like the UI is minimal and clean, and it's quite good. It has got one or two features that I don't find easy in LibreOffice, like, for example, because the way I use Calc is, basically, what I don't find easy is to make alternate rows different color. It's easy in OnlyOffice as it is easy in Excel. And some other kind of icon functionality, it might be better in OnlyOffice, but it lacks... It's a light office suite. It doesn't have all the features of something like LibreOffice or Excel. So, but definitely, as you said, more power, more choice, more power. It's good.
And from looking through the screenshots, it seems to be that just from muscle memory, anyone who's coming over from Microsoft Office with their Ribbon UI might find it more at home with OnlyOffice versus LibreOffice, just the way it's set out by default, especially since the whole color bar and at the top as well. I use Microsoft Office on my work computer when I'm in work, and that whole color bar at the top, like blue for your word processor and that kind of thing, and their whole synergy and integration and all those marketing buzzwords. If you're used to all that, OnlyOffice might be something that would look more similar to you if that is what you're used to.
Well, LibreOffice now offers LibreOffice now offers the ribbon interface as well, but I would also say that for people who are serious about using spreadsheets, VisiData is the way to go. Because, as I was saying last time, it's a proper program in the command line with a ton of functionality. So, OnlyOffice, great for candy and presentation, and for people who want to have a free and open source office suite, but like the way like Microsoft Office is laid out and how it functions, but it doesn't have as many features as LibreOffice does, or indeed Microsoft Office. And I think it's not the old. There are other Office suites as well, and I keep trying them every now and then to see if there's any feature that I would like about them, but I basically go back to using LibreOffice every time, just because I think it's the best option out there for an office suite.
It's certainly in the free and open source office suite world, it certainly has the most development eyes and the most development time dedicated towards it. I say by far it's probably the most actively developed, so it would most likely be the most stable, the most reliable, and also they're introducing new features all the time. So it will be a solid, reliable office suite, and also they're adding on their extra features, so it's quite feature extensive as well. So, two events that we would like to mention. One of them has been kindly mentioned or brought to our attention in Twitter from Diogo Constantino on Twitter. UbuCon is coming up on from the 10th to the 13th of October in Portugal. The link will be in the show notes. So, for anyone who's connected with Ubuntu or would like to learn more about Ubuntu or anything Ubuntu or Canonical related, head over to UbuCon, which is in the 10th to the 13th of October in Portugal. And unfortunately, we will not be attending, because we will be attending OgCamp on, again, October, the 19th to the 20th of October in Manchester in the UK. OgCamp is incredibly fun. There's lots of really friendly community guys around there, great for socializing and networking, and also you get to attend the talks, and there's some really, really interesting talks from when we were there last year, particularly highlighting the one of the guys who's effectively running a mobile phone broadcast aerial off a series of Raspberry Pis, and then went into presentation of the nitty-gritty of, if you want to roll out your own mobile phone network, obviously with the caveat of don't just do this, there's laws and regulations about you doing this, but if you were going to do it, this is how you do it. And he gave a demonstration of a bunch of Raspberry Pis, so that was incredibly, incredibly interesting.
Yeah, and let's not forget that OgCamp gives you the opportunity to sample a lot of alcohol at English prices, which is that I still have got fond memories of that £2.50 for a pint.
That was Sheffield. That was particularly inexpensive. I'm not expecting Manchester to be as inexpensive.
Well, you know, there's Wetherspoons everywhere.
Not all Wetherspoons are equal, as we're finding out in Ireland, because Wetherspoons are over in Ireland, and they're not quite as cheap as that place in Sheffield. So, just because it's a Wetherspoons does not mean that the price is going to be the exact same, no matter where you are.
True that.
So, moving on to our discussion part. One thing that's been brought to our attention again from Twitter, is running Linux on an old laptop from Joey Fallon or Joseph Fallon, however he chooses to say his name, on Twitter. I was looking at the specifications of it and thinking, that's not particularly bad hardware. But then that's me just showing my age, going, I remember when that stuff was new. Are you telling me that that's bad hardware? I remember a laptop with a Core 2 Duo. So with a Core i5, I was like, that's a decent processor, or a Core i3. Sorry.
Yeah, second gen Core i3 with 2 GB of RAM, and apparently it's not working very well. It's quite slow on Lubuntu and Xubuntu as well, with booting via live USB. Right, okay, so I think...
Sorry to interrupt you there, Mike. I might as well do him credence and actually read out the tweet so everyone gets the exact context and in the way that he describes it. So he says, what is the minimum spec laptop you consider putting Linux on? Neighbor has a second gen i3 with 2 GB of RAM. It crawls even with Lubuntu 64-bit or Xubuntu booting off a live USB. Worth adding a cheap SSD? Well, first thoughts for me would be the... Xubuntu would be affected by the fact that it's running off a live USB. Native hardware will always be faster than booting off a live image. But having said that, Xubuntu would tend to be heavier on resources than Lubuntu, and he's saying that even Lubuntu crawls. We were discussing this before we started recording, and we say that definitely worth adding an SSD, probably the best bang for your buck in terms of investment to the difference that you will see it will have on your laptop, is by far getting an SSD. It's one of the best upgrades you could ever invest in, and I would say that with the SSD, Lubuntu should run fine.
Yeah, I agree. I had been using a very old laptop, and I stuck in it a very cheap 125 GB Kingston, and it made it work smoothly. Like I don't think so. Basically, this laptop from just the specs that we quoted, it looks like that even when it was new, it wasn't the best, it wasn't like top tier, because it has only 2 GB of RAM. I think even when second gen i3s were new, like topper, higher value computers would come with like 4 GB or even 8. That's why I'm thinking that the I/O on it is not going to be the fastest. That means that the USB ports are not going to be great either, so that might affect the live USB boot. And definitely the hard drive that's in it is gonna be it's not gonna be like a premium Toshiba or something. It's gonna be something also lower tier. So I think even a cheap SSD should, obviously, with the caveat that I'm not responsible for anything I say, it should improve it. At least that's my experience. That SSD, if you replace a hard drive with an SSD, is always an improvement. As for the distribution, I would, as Connor suggested, I would start with Lubuntu, and then if that still doesn't work, I would basically go down. Obviously, and I would try to install it rather than using live images, because the USBs on that computer might be very slow. The I/O on them, or the bandwidth on the USBs might be very slow. So I would just basically try to install from Lubuntu down distributions. So Connor, before the call, before the recording, mentioned something like Bunsen Labs. If Lubuntu doesn't work out, that's definitely a good idea, because it's a lightweight distro with... did you say it was OpenBox or FluxBox? OpenBox, isn't it?
Bunsen Labs is Open Box, and I've run Open Box or Open Box. I've run Bunsen Labs in virtual machines over the years, like as recently as only a couple of I think only about a month ago, or maybe even less than that, when the new version with Debian Buster came out, and it runs on in about 200 or 300 megs of RAM. As in that's its resources. I'm not saying that would be all you would need to run it, but that is the resources that it uses when it's idling. So I'd say if you've a computer with only 1 gigabyte of RAM, Bunsen Labs should be able to run quite happily. The only caveat with that would be is with some of the more modern programs, I don't know if they would start using up your RAM quite quickly. If you have that old of a computer with only 1 gigabyte of RAM, I would definitely not recommend that you install Chrome. Even Firefox might be a stretch.
I think it's 2 gigabytes of RAM.
I understand that. I was just imagining a scenario of if you were only constrained to 1 gigabyte of RAM. With two gigabytes of RAM, and as you're saying, it is likely that was not maxed out when it was purchased. I would imagine, but Joey Fallon, I would suggest that you confirm this with your neighbor, or even if you can access the hardware yourself to confirm it yourself, is to look up make a model of that laptop and look up the specifications online with a user manual or something that's provided from the manufacturer, and that manual will likely tell you the maximum amount of RAM that motherboard can take, and it's usually, as a good rule, it's usually twice what the original laptop came with. These usually vary, especially if it's a multiple of two. Some laptops came out with 6 gigabytes of RAM. I'm not suggesting that is then capable of running 12 gigs of RAM. It's usually a multiple of two, so if it came with two, the maximum that motherboard can handle is usually 4. If it came with 4, it's usually 8. If it came with 8, it's usually 16, and so on and so forth. But I will definitely look into that. The two hardware upgrades I would recommend would certainly be, first, getting the SSD. Second, if you can research it and if you can find out the specific generation of RAM that it uses, and if it can still be purchased at a reasonable price. Sometimes older RAM go up in price because of its scarcity. Would be to then double the RAM. So you then have a Core i3 with 4 gigs of RAM and a 120 gig or 256 gig or 500 gig or whatever you can afford SSD inside the laptop. And with those specifications, I would imagine that Lubuntu would for sure should be able to run on it, no problem at all. I was hazard to guess that Zubuntu with XFCE should be fine, or Ubuntu Mate, running the Mate desktop as well. You may even be able to run regular Ubuntu with GNOME on it, or Kubuntu with KDE, but your mileage will vary. But I would certainly do those hardware upgrades, then look into Lubuntu and Zubuntu and Ubuntu Mate, and who knows, even if the hardware is more than capable of running those distributions, you might settle on it and go, you know, I actually like Lubuntu, I actually like Zubuntu, I actually like Ubuntu Mate, and you do not feel that you need to upgrade to the quote-unquote more flashy desktops that use greater hardware resources.
Well, or you might go the other way and realize that there is a correct way of doing thing, and that's install Arch or Manjaro with i3 on that thing. It would fly, probably.
yeah, and, definitely. i3 would definitely fly.
And your neighbor might even thank you after he learns how to use it if he doesn't know now, because in complete seriousness, that's what I did on the original Pinebook, and that is really good. So Manjaro with i3 is extremely fast. It doesn't take almost any resources, so you would have all that RAM, or most of that RAM, still left intact for browsing, which is what really is the most resource-hungry activity for most users. And I can recommend it, and it's at least for me, it's worth the learning curve to use i3, because eventually it boils down to few, maybe 5 or 10 keyboard shortcuts that, and even you can use your mouse as well, obviously, on i3. And then once people learn that, it becomes a really good experience.
Yeah, your mileage may vary. Just because I was curious, I just brought up my system monitor on my computer at the moment, and I ranked it by memory so that the highest resources are at the top. And Firefox is only using about 275 or less than 300 megabytes of RAM. But granted, I only have 2 tabs open. So as you open up tabs, obviously that would shoot up. But it's not the heavy behemoth that everyone is making it out to be. So I would say suggest that maybe use Firefox over something that is Chromium based, like Chrome or Vivaldi or Opera or all those, or Brave, we're all Chromium based. I would suggest that maybe Firefox will be a better resource user of RAM than anything Chromium based, but again, it'll be down to your individual tastes.
And also, there are a few extensions that can help people with Firefox browsing the web more economically. One of them is I think it's called Node.js. It disables JavaScript and allows the user to allow it per site, which obviously may affect rendering and some sites might not work. But at least if one strays onto something like The Verge, which is loaded with a ton of scripts, the browser doesn't freeze into standstill. And another one would be, I forgot what it's called, but it's basically a tab manager. It freezes tabs, it kind of, or suspends tabs that are not used. So once a user switches back to the tab, it has to reload, but they don't take up as many resources if they are not used. So if people have got multiple tabs open, that's also a very good extension. And there are some, I think there is either Mozilla or some other website, or maybe more websites that can help people use Firefox with less resources. And I've once done this optimization on the Pinebook, and since then Firefox became much more leaner and easier to use as well.
Yeah, some very good tips there. So I think we will start to wrap things up. So as always, if you want to get in touch with us, we are on Telegram, which is telegram.com/LinuxLads. We're on Twitter @LinuxLads. We're on Facebook. Just search for Linux Lads. Mastodon, again, it's Linux Lads.
At Linux Lads at hostux.social, but it's going to be in the show notes.
Or email us at show@linuxlads.com. And also, if you want to throw us a fiver or a tenner for a coffee, or just helping with our ongoing costs like hosting or anything like that, is linuxlads.com/support, and it's all very much appreciated. So for this episode, I have been Connor.
And I've been Mike.
Bye.
Bye.